Hello, my name is Michael Albert, and this is the 178th consecutive episode of the podcast that's titled Revolution Z. We had a late postponement, so today I have to do our 10th Ruminations episode. Ruminations episodes, remember, are basically whatever on my mind as it emerges as we're doing the episode. It's kind of a spontaneous thing. Since it's on my mind, I will start with something quite personal. I guess one might call it. I hadn't anticipated this, but here we go. A few days back, I had my first doctor's appointment in 3 years. I'm not much for going to the doctor unless there's something wrong. And I had moved, so I got a new doctor. So it was my first time seeing this new doctor. And I wasn't feeling quite so great. For various reasons, I went, and for the first, catching up, checkup, etc., I was fine, picture of health, etc. At the end of the session, he started taking a look at my scalp under my hair, what's left of it, and wouldn't you know it, he found something he didn't like. These things are called by various names and can be various things. So it could be, actually, I have them all over, just a spot, larger or smaller, has various causes, there's absolutely no consequence. So that's what everything except this particular area that he scrounged up on my scalp was. This, he thought, was perhaps even likely, a melanoma, which is a skin cancer. When I was a kid, melanoma was essentially a death sentence. Nowadays, I don't think that's the case. I think there's various ways of dealing with it, depending upon how far along it is. But of course, that gets ahead of the story. We don't yet know what this is. So I had to go get a biopsy, and I did that yesterday. That's where they basically take a little bit, for those of you who don't watch medical shows on TV or aren't doctors, you take a little bit of the suspicious entity, it could be a growth on your kidney or wherever, or it could be skin, and they then process it and determine what's what. So they did this, and it'll be a week before I get results. So right now, and for basically a week, this was yesterday that was done, I sit and wait. All right, that's not such a interesting story, I don't think, and I don't mean to burden you with it. But it is on my mind, and to be honest, to ruminations, I'm supposed to talk about that. So is there a political link to this? Well, maybe. I thought about it after I got home and, mulling on it, watching some TV, distraction, reading, and I decided that, honestly, my current situation, possible catastrophe, possible gigantic intrusion on life, but not catastrophic, and possibly nothing, is not that different from what is now commonplace for some people, arguably all people, and dealt with similarly, I suspect. So how am I dealing with it? Well, I'm dealing with it by basically a kind of denial mixed with a kind of exploration, I suppose you could call it. There are moments when I just take the worst case scenario as the likely outcome and start thinking about what I do in that case. And then there are other moments, more often, and most of the time when I'm not thinking about it at all, which is most of the time, when I'm in a kind of denial, I suppose you could say. I'm basically assuming that it just won't be that bad. It'll be something, either nothing or something handleable, treatable, manageable. And now consider the feeling is a kind of variation on the notion that doom alone awaits around the next corner. And isn't that something that is in many people's minds now? The pandemic, climate, global warming, ecological nightmares, war, internal societal social disillusion, How do we, writ large, and perhaps even writ individually for each person who's listening to this, respond to these forebearers of doom alone awaiting around the next corner? Because surely you could see it that way. And how do we respond? I think partly with denial, partly with, okay, it's going to be horrible. What's the next thing that I do? And partly with, you know, worrying over, angsting over, and elaborating upon in our heads the worst scenario. The thing is, none of those responses, in the case of pandemic, climate war, internal social dissolution, are that sensible, I think. Whereas I honestly think that, you know, I'm not being crazy combining those kinds of response to the waiting game of waiting for a biopsy result. And the reason I think there's a difference is because the feeling of hopelessness, that is, we can't influence it, is true with the biopsy. I can't do anything. I just have to sit here and wait. But on the other fronts, I think that's not the case. I think on the other fronts, yes, they do foreshadow potential calamity, catastrophe, even doom. But it's not the case that we can do nothing. And so if we sort of go into a denial mode or a, okay, plumb the depths of the horror mode, we are not doing what has a potential merit. Take the pandemic. First of all, is there a denial mode? Is there a mode of, okay, plumb the depths of the horror and just basically figure out how to respond to it when it unfolds? I think both those things exist for the pandemic. And the pandemic is closest, I suppose, in some sense, to period that I'm in, because the pandemic, after all, is disease also. But the reality is that when we are in denial, that is when we say to ourselves, well, it's over. There's nothing to worry about now. There's no real concern. Onward. Or when we say to ourselves, it's hopeless, in either case, we're not just trying to manage our own response, we're simultaneously affecting the prospects of what will emerge. Because even if this pandemic, COVID, was over, and I think it's not, but even if it was, even if it was going to now be, you know, like the flu, something manageable, something that's dealt with, something that doesn't disrupt the entirety of societies, and so on. Even if it was that, it wouldn't mean that pandemics are over. There's every reason to believe that, regrettably, the kind of phenomena and circumstances and factors that led to COVID can lead to another. And so we can be back where we were, unless, instead of denying and assuming it's all over, we take steps. If it's continuing, of course the steps are important. You know, the anti-vaxxers, the people who arguably saying, you know, there's no need for masks and there's no need for social distancing, and we're doing so even at the height of it. You know, I can empathize with what's going on in their feelings and thoughts. They want to get on with life. And they also feel helpless in the face of it, and so they just, you know, try to get by. But the reality is that a collective response, and a much more important collective response in the form of pressure on social institutions and in support of those who are trying to change those institutions and change the probability of pandemics in the future, is really what's warranted. I know you all know this, but, you know, there's an element of knowing, and then there's an element of knowing, and they're not entirely the same. There's academic knowledge, and there's knowledge in your gut. Global warming is the same way. It could be the end of everything. Let's lump it in with all the other ecological problems that are emerging. So what do we do? Do we hunker down, say to ourselves, well, it's 50 years off, the giant calamity is 50 years off or 30 years off or whatever, make the best of it and don't angst over it? Do we say, well, it's exaggerated, it's not really that dangerous. It's not really an existential crisis or a gigantic crisis or whatever you want to call it, sort of denial. Or do we face facts, face that it is an existential crisis, face that it, whether it's further off or nearer, it's going to affect humanity. It affects our offspring or ourselves. And actually, I think it's ourselves. And the only response that ultimately is going to have an impact is massive political participation in a dissident manner to force institutions to accommodate the changes that are needed. And if we really understand that, then you know, it's like, I don't know, if you're in the street and there's a car barreling toward you, you don't deny that there's a car barreling toward you, and you don't say, oh, well, I'll just live with the result. You get out of the damn way. And if there is something barreling towards you which could be pushed off its track, you try and push it off its track. When it's bigger, when it's the whole of society, I guess we have trouble going from seeing it to seeing what's necessary. Same thing is true about war. Same thing is true about internal social dissolution. War beckons now. It's happening. It's not just happening in Ukraine. It's happening everywhere. Guns are being shot at people. Bombs are exploding at people. Countries, political forces are pursuing ends by violent means. So internal social dissolution is happening everywhere that, I don't know what to call it, a degree of frustration and despair is combining with a degree of manipulative, vile self-serving and yielding an outpouring of irrationality, of attachment to inclinations, values, and behaviors that are self-destructive and socially destructive. And that isn't just on the right. It's also on the left. You can also see it in our own institutions. In a sense, they mirror the world around us. So what we're talking about then is in this strange juxtaposition of personal threat, fear, possible disaster that certainly not just I, but a great many people are dealing with in various forms, and the social potential threat, fear, disaster in many forms. The link is somehow our psychological response, or so it seems to me anyway. And perhaps this points again to something that, of course, you all know I keep harping on, but about which I've had a slight change of mind recently, or a slight broadening of mind recently. The thing is the need for vision, the need to know ballpark, roughly, in fundamental terms, where we want to go. What do we want instead of the sexist, misogynist, masculinist mess that is current kinship relations and the damage that it does to us? What do we want instead of the current cultural, community, racial, ethnic situation that we endure that divides, that hurts, that cripples, that denies, that we endure? What do we want instead of a political system whose insanity is more and more revealed every day, in which the political institutions are structured in such a way that a very small number of people, a small constituency, determines the life situations and circumstances of everyone else? They might do it under the rubric, under the name democracy. They might do it under the name oligarchy. But all in all, what's going on is that the few are deciding norms, rules, legislation, adjudication of disputes, and the implementation of collective programs on their own behalf, not in a manner that reflects the will and the needs and the desires of the many. And what do we want in place of an economy, capitalism, or for that matter, what I've called coordinatorism, which again elevates a group, a sector of the population, owners in the case of capitalism, what I call the coordinator class in the case of coordinatorism, sometimes called 20th century socialism, to a dominant position which determines outcomes, which accrues benefits, which imposes the costs on others, which creates inequality, impoverishment, indignity, denial, and all the rest. What do we want in the place of all that? Why is that even a matter of concern now? With all these crises that we face, with the need to address global warming, with the need to address poverty at its grossest, with the need to address the perversion of political institutions, with the need to address violence and rape, and now the denial of abortion possibilities for so many, with the need to address the violence against communities, blacks, Latin, Asian, with the need to address all that immediately, why the hell do we need to talk about vision, which sure as hell isn't immediate? It's not going to happen tomorrow. For those who think it is, it's not. It takes time. So why bother? Well, the reason to bother is because knowing where we want to go informs how we try to get there, provides hope, provides a reason to struggle, provides a reason to give one's time to movement activity. So I've said for a long time, and I've tried to work hard to promote vision, mostly for me around economics, but also around kinship and community and politics, all of which are equally important. All right, what's the change? The change is, a number of people have formulated this to me, and they've said basically, we agree, having vision, having a point at which we're attempting to get, will inform how we get there, of course. It will provide hope and direction and commitment, of course. But there's an obstacle to people even paying attention to vision, even hearing the words of it, even, you know, much less, you know, seriously and with a degree of rigor, considering, let's call it visionary proposals, to try and decide their merit and their implementability, their viability, in order to perhaps share them and to become advocates. And what is that obstacle? The obstacle is not just, and this vision tries to overcome directly, not just skepticism that anything better is possible, not just concern that maybe people are just too screwed up to do anything better, not just that, which the sort of visionary impetus tries to address directly, but something slightly different, which is the notion that you can't beat City Hall. That is, that's an old formulation of it, you can't beat the, you know, the governmental, corporate, military, academic, media giganticism that maintains and will fight to maintain the current system against any better vision. And if you can't reach a better vision, it's just academic, it's just noodling to propose one. To propose something that's unreachable is a waste of time. Maybe it's good for curiosity, maybe it's good for a novel, but it's not good for movements. Or so goes the feeling, and so goes the widespread disinclination to give much time to the topic. And what this leads to, I think, is the observation that not only do we need vision, so in the case of what I advocate, the vision of a participatory society, and in particular, in my particular case of what I advocate, the vision of a participatory economy, but we also need to talk about and to arrive at hope about and to arrive at shared thoughts about strategy for getting there, strategy for winning that future. Now, here there's a complication, because there is no one strategy. it's not as if there's no one vision either, right? So take economics. Participatory economics, I describe it as a scaffold upon which we build a future economy. So it's just the essential and the core features is the vision. Different places, different times, different prior histories will yield different details, different ways of filling out the scaffold to become a whole economy. I mean, just like there's not just one kind of capitalism, one instance of it that is always and exactly the same in all countries. It has many elements built upon the core that is the same. So participatory economics, I think, is like that. It's a proposal for a different kind of economy, meaning a different set of core underlying defining relations upon which future people will create, implement, sustain, refine all sorts of additional features that fill it out to become a full economy. Same thing for participatory kinship or community or polity. The vision is the core essential elements. Okay, so now let's go back to strategy. We're trying to attain this new result, this new society in which the crises that we experience no longer exist, in which not just that, but business as usual is no longer denial, denigration, division, impoverishment, and so on, in which people are living full lives and controlling their own lives. Okay. But there is no one strategy, because in different countries at different times and in different places and with different choices, new contexts arrive. And in the new context, new choices are made. And so what we need, I think, is some clarity about, some shared thoughts about, some allegiance to a broad strategic conception that is in tune with the kind of vision that we want to attain, that is consistent with the kind of vision that we want to attain, that can attain the kind of vision that we want to attain. Not all the tactics, not all the steps, not all the multitude of circumstances which we will encounter, many of which we can't know now, some of which we can know and predict as possibilities, but rather a conception of how we deal, a conception of how we judge choices, how and against what rubric, for example, enlarging the number of people who align with our cause, enlarging the commitment and the competency, the consciousness of the people who do align with our cause, winning changes that are such that they accumulate in a positive way, and winning them in a manner which creates a conduciveness to winning more changes, so that we're winning a trajectory of change, if you will, that's moving us closer to what it is that we desire for society. And finally, of course, constructing, building, maintaining the new institutions, those core defining institutions that we need for future people to be able to self-manage their way to full, consistent, stable, worthy new social systems. At any rate, it seems to me, as much of a mouthful as all that is, that it is what's needed. And yet, it seems like there's another thing needed. And I'll maybe bring this to a conclusion with this, although it'll take a bit. The other thing that's needed, let's assume for a minute that we achieve what I just talked about. We achieve a degree of widespread unity, shared conception, not universal agreement about everything at all, but shared conception about the defining features of goals that we desire, and defining practices, general methods, and evaluative procedures and strategic goals for the path that we take to that goal. Suppose we do that. There's still another issue, I think. And the other issue is, if we continue as now, if we continue as last year, if we continue as last decade, if we continue as we have for decades, right? It isn't an entirely new phenomenon, though right now it is particularly, I don't know how to describe it, it is particularly widespread and virulent. If we continue to fight ourselves, if we continue to form what are called circular firing squads, if we continue have no way to deal with each other when we differ, other than to choose up sides and denigrate those not on our side, while elevating those on our side, leaving behind all elements of listening, of empathy, of trying to resolve differences, of trying to even maintain differences inside one structure with diversity, with respect, instead of saying that those who differ from me must be literally opposed, must have sharply different values, must be an enemy. If we can't overcome that, if we can't overcome what's called sometimes sectarianism, nowadays cancel culture, if we can't overcome these kinds of dynamics that rip us apart, then even as we try to attain a shared vision and try to attain a shared strategy, our efforts will be undone by the kind of cultural dynamic, the kind of interpersonal reflex behaviors that we carry. These things are not so different from what exists out there in the wider society beyond us. We don't want to replicate racism in our movement. We don't want to replicate sexism in our movement. We don't want to replicate class hierarchy in our movement. We don't want to replicate authoritarianism in our movement. But we haven't yet come to the conclusion, come to the realization, that we do not want to replicate the kind of interpersonal hostilities and defensiveness and aggressiveness that characterize life outside in our movement. Not because we're trying to make some isolated, wonderful entity, but because those habits, those patterns and ways of behaving are destructive and will destroy our efforts to create a better society. And so, I guess what the upshot is, oddly coming from, you know, this personal circumstance, is that we not only need vision, meaning, and understanding of the defining core features of the society we wish to accomplish, we wish to attain, not a blueprint, but that which is essential for it to be worthy, that which is essential for it to be viable, and a strategic mode of thinking, of operating, of evaluating our choices, of understanding our potential audience, of relating to it, we also need to somehow arrive at and incorporate in our efforts a culture, I guess you could call it, a way of interpersonally relating when there is difference, even significant difference, that isn't destructive, but is constructive, that doesn't call out, denigrate, and cancel, but instead manages to call in and to align, or at least respect and maintain differences to explore and experiment with an open mind about which will prove to be more accurate and more productive. I hope this wasn't totally, I don't know what word to use, rambling. I am a bit distracted, I suppose you could say, and I apologize for that. But all that said, this is Mike Albert, signing off until next time for Revolution Z.